The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Kim Christfort. Kim is the architect and global leader of Deloitte's Business Chemistry and national managing director of the Deloitte Greenhouse Experience, where she and her team advance the science of experiential engagement and apply those insights with hundreds of companies every year, diagnosing why groups get stuck, crafting methods that unlock opportunities, and facilitating immersive, interactive sessions that accelerate breakthroughs. She has an MBA from Stanford University, and she is the co-author, along with Suzanne Vickberg, of a new book, Business Chemistry, Practical Magic for Crafting Powerful Work Relationships. Kim Christfort, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I have to tell you, I get squirrely when it comes to things like personality tests, and you won me over on page 10 when you wrote, quote, "We trust that you, as our readers, will understand that we're using a shortcut. We thank you in advance for remembering that we're simplifying," end quote. Because there's so much gray and crossover. However, we have to start somewhere, and that's what this book does. It sort of says, here's a baseline to work from, but understand that there's plenty of nuance and context in play.
That's exactly right. What we're largely trying to do is have people start looking for patterns, and those patterns are just the starting point to remind us that everybody's different and to give us a higher probability of connecting with them in a way that's effective.
And the problem is, right, our biases love patterns, but they're not always the right patterns. In fact, they often mislead us.
That's exactly right. And the mind is just so eager to jump to conclusions, literally. And what we're trying to do here is replace a tendency which may be based off of some instinct that you have with one that's based off of data. And the system that we've used is essentially a mathematical model. It looks for correlations between things that are observable behaviors. And therefore, if you tend to see one of those behaviors, you are likely to see others. The metaphor we use most frequently is that of tells in poker. Mm-hmm. You know, when people bluff in poker, you're hoping you can pick up on it through a tell, and you may be right. And it's, you know, if you start noticing those things, you might have a higher probability of being right, but you could be wrong.
And before, and I do want to jump in, obviously, to the business chemistry sort of archetypes that you lay out. But before you do that, you talk about empathy, and we've had so many different people, whether it's sort of certainly from an improv context, we deal with this, you know, sort of empathetic communication, but we've had sort of design thinking people. You write, quote, "We suspected that the secret sauce was empathy. Decades of studies have shown that empathy is integral to effective human connection, and recent research further demonstrates links between empathy and leadership performance." And I don't think people often think about empathy and leadership, but you do.
Yes, empathy is key because so much of what we're trying to do relies on people. And if we can't understand where those people are coming from, how to motivate them, how to get them working with one another, we're missing out on a huge business lever. And so we see this as twofold, really. There's personal leadership. How do I personally understand others and relate to them differently and be more effective in those individual interactions? And then there's also team and organizational leadership. How do I create a culture that can actually incorporate the strengths of the people around me and being able to walk in their shoes to know what those strengths really are?
And here it might be smart to say what we think empathy is, because I do see that that trips people up, and you can't really start cultivating empathy unless you can define it. So how do you define empathy in this context?
Yeah, empathy is really, from our standpoint, has two parts of it. One part is understanding where a person is coming from, so the way that they may be thinking about things, the way that they may be processing things, what is going on in that person's mind. And then the second part of empathy for us is doing something with that information. Because if you just understand where they're coming from, that's nice, and maybe you're sympathetic, maybe you have feelings of commiseration, but you're not actually demonstrating empathy. And so it's the translation from a hypothesis into an action that we really think brings together the full formula and power of empathy.
I love that, because that completely refutes Paul Bloom's against empathy theories, who's a very smart academic, but he tends to believe that empathy does just the first part of that equation. It allows you to so relate to someone that you're disinclined to maybe have hard conversations. This book is totally opposite. The idea is the only way you can have hard conversations and difficult conversations is if you do understand where someone's at, because that's where the good stuff lie. It's not an easy thing. In fact, if you're doing it right, it's probably a hard thing.
That's exactly right. And I think that we also make the mistake sometimes of assuming that being empathic is doing for someone what we would want to have done. You know, so I'm being so empathic because, you know, I know that I would like the flexibility to work from home. And so I'm going to give you that flexibility, you know, as a new parent or whatever it may be. When the reality is, if I actually were thinking about that person, that situation, that solution may not at all be what they want. And so it's really trying to put yourself outside of your own headspace and into their world and then look back at where you could possibly draw a path to the goal. You're never going to be in a situation where you wouldn't consider the goal, but it's about how do you optimize for a different set of variables rather than just assuming there's one solution to get to that end objective.
Right. One of the scholars we work with at the University of Chicago, we have a thing called the Second Science Project, which looks at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. And Nick Epley, who's the scholar there, talks about the fact that they've used control groups who have their job is to better understand the person across from them. They've got a second group that they say, we really want you to be empathetic and really get into this person's shoes. And they have a third group where they basically say, ask them a lot of questions. And it's that third group that usually gets the most information out of the person, not necessarily the group that is just saying to understand. So this idea of making empathy active is absolutely crucial, and I think fairly new in terms of the way people think about this.
Yeah, and I love that example you're giving about ask people questions, because essentially that's what we're trying to do with business chemistry. You're asking the questions, but they're answering through the way that they behave. So I may not say to you, you know, do you really like making decisions quickly? But I'll watch how you behave and I'll say, gosh, you know what? He likes to make decisions quickly. And based on that, I have a much better sense of where you might be starting from, again, linking back to these patterns that we've seen.
Yeah, it's a form of rapid prototyping, I think. Right? I mean, you know, and we know, you know, if you think about, and I don't know how much you know about Second City, but since 1959, we have sort of crowdsourced ideas for the comedy. That's how improvisation works. And it's a really effective way to get at cutting edge comedy. And when you think about it, it's like, oh, no, we're asking the audience what they want over and over again. And that's getting us to that place. And that is exactly what you see across so many different kinds of technology, but also, I think, in organizational psychology and all that. Let's jump into these business chemistry archetypes, because you have four of them. And again, they're a place to start from. It's not like there's four ways of being human. But they break down to pioneers, guardians, drivers, and integrators. And so let's just start with pioneers. Who are they? What's that type?
In a word, pioneers are all about possibilities, and I am actually a huge fan of Second City and believe in the yes and philosophy. The yes and philosophy is most natural to that pioneer group because they're always looking to build and expand and explore. They tend to be very adaptable, very quick to do things. They do it based on gut feel, don't need the data, don't need the facts. They just feel like it's the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right, so we can call out me, because another aspect of this, because I'm a Second City guy, is aversion to details, which anyone who's worked with me will say.
Yes. Actually, one of the funny things I should point out about these patterns is that some of these types of pioneers, are one of them, are as defined by the things they dislike as the things that they like. And that's
totally
very important to remember. You know, if you're working with individuals, you know, sometimes you may be inadvertently doing things that they absolutely despise and you're just not even aware of it.
Yeah. So I knew this. I learned this about myself in a leadership role at Second City. So that's when I hired my dear friend Monica to be my guardian. So the guardian type is another one, and you can explain what that is.
Yes, the perfect tip, because these things are on a spectrum. And so the pioneer is that possibilities that doesn't like the detail. The guardians are at the other end of the spectrum. They're all about stability. They want to make sure that everything is done exactly the right way. They're meticulous. They are very honor bound to tradition. They want things done in a way that's tried and true. And so what you describe is one of the things that we're advocating in the book. It's finding these healthy combinations where instead of that being a source of tension and conflict, the fact that you don't want to deal with the details and she's detail-oriented, you make it a source of complementary power.
Yeah, yeah. And we're going to get into diversity of teams, and that's part of this. But the other two are important, too, because a driver is the third one that you talk about. And that's an interesting, really interesting type.
Yeah, so drivers are all about challenge, very analytical, very goal-oriented. There's actually two flavors of the driver. There's one that's more outward-oriented, that commander type, we call it, mm-hmm. and one that's more inward-oriented, more experimental. We call that the scientist.
Yeah.
Their opposite end of the spectrum, the integrator, is all about connection between ideas, connection between people, and they have two flavors as well. They have that outward-oriented teamer, as we call it, and the more inward-oriented dreamer.
Yeah. If I'm integrator pioneer, if I'm using these types, and you make a point of saying there's very few people who are one of any of these. Everyone has elements of their own being and the process in which they work. And then recognize this, too. They might work depending, you know, sort of outwardly they're a pioneer. And then, you know, when they're working inside teams, they might be a driver. That it can be that different.
Exactly. Everybody's a mix of all four types, but most people are defined by one or two of those. And if you are balanced across all the types, it just means you're not as extreme on any of them. The point about inward and outward, I think, is very interesting because you hear a lot of discussion about extroversion and introversion in the broader media. And what our system is showing is that there is a blending, there is a mix. So for me, for example, I'm a primary pioneer, which is very outward oriented, but my secondary is a scientist driver, which is more inward oriented. And as you say, that's going to manifest differently depending on the environment in which I find myself.
Yeah. So let's talk about introverts and extroverts, because you note that there's not a universally agreed upon definition really in the sort of science realm of what that is. But business, people and business have made all these kinds of assumptions. And you note Susan Cain's work. She's done some powerful work in this area, that business actually has undervalued introverts sort of consistently throughout the arc, at least in modern business.
Yeah, and I think that when you look at what the data is showing on our side, you can have some hypotheses about why they might be undervalued. You know, the more inward-oriented types don't necessarily like to toot their own horn. They tend to be a little bit more humble. They love contributing in ways that are maybe less traditional, not that leader who's sort of shouting in front of the troops, but the expert who knows everything about a topic and leads from that position of expertise, or the mentor who's coaching other people to rise and be able to take those management roles. And so there's many different types of leadership. The stereotypical charismatic leader maps against a lot of those outward-oriented characteristics. And there is a bit of a selection bias, likely on both sides, likely on the side of the people hiring for leaders who have that you know, mentality of this charismatic leader in mind, and maybe on the individuals themselves, because they know that that role is going to require things that perhaps are outside of their comfort zone, or that don't let them play to the things that they really care about, where they would rather invest their time.
So this makes me think of that example from the Houston Rockets basketball team and Daryl Morey, who is their president of basketball operations, who after he took a behavioral economics course, he made his scouts stop comparing any of these new recruits to players of the same race. He's like, basically, if you've got a white player, I want you to compare him to an African-American player and vice versa, because he kept feeling that they would just fall into this bias, this stereotype that was just based on appearance. And that's something that I totally think we see in business, where you suddenly have these people who get promoted because they wear the confidence of a great leader, but they don't necessarily have any of the attributes of a great leader.
Precisely. And I think that's part of what makes this so difficult, is that in today's world, a leadership role is multifaceted. There are many, many ways potentially to be successful as a leader in that. And yet, oftentimes, there's this stereotype in mind of the single model for success. And I think that's antiquated. We're seeing more and more also that companies recognize that leadership is a team sport.
Right.
And so there isn't necessarily that single person who needs to do everything. There's a mix of different leaders who are going to work together across the C-suite or across the organization to really be effective. And that's where diversity becomes even more important, because if you have one individual with a very distinct style who has a distinct way, that could perhaps be balanced out by other pieces. But if you have an entire leadership team that all looks the same, you suddenly have a pretty big wave in a certain direction.
Yeah, and I suspect, well, I think I know, that team leadership, this ability, and we have a phrase in improv called follow the follower, which is that leadership operates in a dynamic. You know, you trade it around with the person who needs to wear it at the moment. But we're so stuck on the binary. We like, just as I imagine this is how we've evolved as human beings, and that right or wrong, good or bad, that we forget that sort of nuanced communication that exists. You have a great quote by Steve Schloss, who is the chief people officer at the U.S. Golf Association. He said, quote, "If you want applause, you can speak all you want, but if you want results, you have to listen." And I think great leadership, at least in a contemporary context, are people who are incredibly generous listeners.
Yes. And to your earlier point, you know, this idea of following a follower, that takes this intense focus and this sort of 360-degree view in a way, right? You're not just looking at a single individual and handing the power stick back and forth. It's
right.
Much more complicated than that. And I think that's been a big adjustment, to recognize that leadership does need to shift, and you do need to be listening not only for what your other leaders are positioned to do or how they're able to contribute, but listening to signals in the market, listening to your customers. It is an entirely different set of skills, and it's why, again, going back to empathy, that's so important, because you need to be hyper aware of the people around you, how they're going to respond, and how you can maybe best position to be effective ultimately.
You have a like killer observation in here, and it was one that I boxed and circled and boxed again. And the full the full quote is, "You may be a brilliant visionary who can paint a picture of a new future that will make people swoon. You have to be a great you may be a great communicator that communication experts ask for your advice, but chances are you're still under communicating about your ideas." So, God, I just think this is so brilliant. So we do not communicate enough about anything and everything, is what you're saying, and I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, and it's so human, right?
Yeah.
Because you feel like you are strong on your message, you're strong on whatever it is you're trying to do, but there's so many assumptions built into that. The assumption that people are actually listening when you speak.
Right.
The assumption that you're speaking in a way that they can actually understand. With business chemistry, we talk about it a lot as a language,
mm-hmm.
and these are essentially foreign languages. There's four different primary languages, and so oftentimes leaders aren't heard because they're speaking a language that no one else gets, and they're not taking the time to either acknowledge that it's a foreign language or to perhaps learn these other languages so that it can communicate in a way that's more effective.
Yeah, well, communication begins at the person's ear that you're speaking to, not the mouth where it's coming from. And that orientation is not how we walk around in the world, certainly. And then we underestimate all the distractions, right? And there's so much worse right now with regard to like instant messaging and social media feeds. And it's like the ability of recognizing how much I need to turn off in order to actually turn on and really use my brain. It was bad before. It's always been bad, and now it's sort of supercharged through digital and tech means.
You're absolutely right, and it takes extra effort to do this because our natural state is going to be to fall into what works for us and the way we think about things and just go with that. To do what you're talking about, we need to not only get through all those distractions, but we need to spend time thinking about all the different players. We need to spend time thinking through the implications, and that's hard. Ultimately, though, that extra effort pays off. So it's an investment that you make, but you make it knowing that the result will be far better.
And you also bring up an important thing. So, you know, yes, understand that there's digital challenges and there's human challenges, but there's this expertise syndrome that happens and that people change as they gain power. And often the studies I've read mean that the more power, the more status you have, the less sort of truth is available to you, both in terms of people being honest with you, but also your elevated position kind of just seeing things not necessarily in the most accurate way.
We certainly see that. I think that there is always a reluctance in a system to provide true feedback upward because you don't know what the consequences are. And so that can tend to isolate a leader from the truth. At the same time, that leader can become very secure in their position and confident that what they're doing must work because, after all, that's how they ended up in this position, and they may not be as receptive to things that don't jive with that worldview. I have heard many times leaders say, oh, yeah, we get it. Like, intellectually, that makes sense, but, you know, this is the way we're going to do it because it works. It's my way or the highway thinking, and that is unfortunate, I think, because it often, again, feels easier and feels like it's going to be successful, but misses so many of either the sources of potential that could be tapped into by broadening that viewpoint, or overlooks key risks and lands them in positions where they have these unexpected circumstances and aren't positioned to respond.
So I'm curious with you, so you've been in business for a while, I've been in business for a while. When I started reading the literature in this area, I found an actual great relief in the idea that there is no way I've got it right or I could be all-knowing, that just is an essential untruth. And I found that freed me up as a leader to be better, to actually have more agency, and also freed me up because it meant that I can empower more people who work around me to bring in their ideas. And this is a very sort of improv principle, but, you know, I always talk about at Second City, we're doctors who smoke. We have all these great improv principles. And then we get into the boardroom and we completely forget them when we say no. But we're funny, so we call each other out on it. But I'm curious with you. So you start reading this literature, you're working in business, you're like, oh man, this is so true. Did it free you up or did it put you in your head? Because you've been in these leadership positions.
Yeah, it's interesting because your perspective on this to me sounds very pioneer integrator. You know, you're basically open to not knowing everything, not knowing all the details. You want to include everybody else. That's very, you know, so open to those things is very pioneer. The sort of wanting to include and empower other people is very integrator. It feels to me like your response is very true to the way you've described your business chemistry patterns. You know, for me, as a pioneer driver, a lot of this I've taken as that's fascinating and how can I test what may work or not.
Right.
So I've gone into the same sort of opportunity space as you, but I've gone a little bit more into, I wonder if there's a way to dial this in. Yeah, there's no right answer, but, you know, could I find a new way? Could I try something different? What are some small experiments we could make to see what might work better?
That's interesting. I was doing research today because I'm taping a podcast with Dan Ariely tomorrow, and looking at some of his work in ethics. And he was the thing I was just reading is about, can you measure misbehaving? It turns out yes, you can.
We're all in trouble now.
We are seriously. Well, we all cheat. Apparently, that's. You'll have to listen to that episode, but this that idea, and I know again, being a non-detail person, right? That measurement thing always scares me a little bit, but it is exactly another place to go when you are, when you're inquiring and when you sort of have the feeling of like, okay, I want to get to the truth rather than get to what's convenient. And again, the problem we've got is I think most people would say they agree with that statement, but I think we would both say that most people don't operate like they agree with that statement.
Exactly. It's intellectual, but it's not followed through upon. And I love the doctor smoking example. And that's not universally true. And I actually have found that as teams have open conversations about some of this, and as you say, you know, you call one another on it, you see the behavior, you call it out, that you do start to see change happen because people don't like to be inconsistent. I think, again, it's that they're not taking the time to necessarily reflect upon it. They're just going back into that comfort zone.
All right. So in a second, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story, but I always kind of pluck out some lines from the books I read and from the people I interview because they just sort of intrigue me. You wrote in the book, quote, "Not everyone aspires to be a leader." Why is that important to know?
I think that I hear from a lot of people, gosh, you know, I feel like I really should be doing this in my career, or I should be doing that. And there's a lot of angst and regret about the path they've taken. And oftentimes it's because they've defined a single path to success. And that success has this big leadership blinking sign at the top of it. And I always like to ask them, what really makes you happy? What makes you feel like you're doing something valuable with your time? You know, if you weren't worried about that blinking light in the corner office, you know, where do you see yourself going? And you get all sorts of interesting answers back as a result of that question. And that's where I think in today's world, there's so many different ways to contribute and make an impact. And I actually believe that is leadership of a different sort. It's just not the way that it's classically defined. And so I think it's important to not have that single definition of success. If you don't want to be a leader, you're not an ambitious person, you're not a person who wants to make a difference.
My wife has this theory about Second City casts over the years, and we've both worked at Second City over 30 years, so we may be right, we may be wrong. But she always looks for an alpha in the cast, but not in the sense of like it's the loudest person. It's the one whose behavior is a model. So that it's very hard, for example, to be unethical, to not yes and, to not focus on another person's needs if you have someone who has that characteristic inside the ensemble. And this is where I think our work kind of intersects with ethics, because you can't necessarily teach ethics. If the point of teaching ethics is that someone is going to be ethical, just talking about it does nothing. The literature is very clear on that. The evidence is clear on that. But when they have to model it and practice it over a period of time, that's where you can have this effect. So much like you have talk to me in the book about testing, I think that's another way to sort of put this stuff in a laboratory.
Yes, I agree. And it's interesting that she's looking for the alpha to play that kind of role. And I think that makes perfect sense for that situation. And you could see opportunities for other kinds of leaders. You want the person in the group that's going to make sure that everybody is included and contributing. You're going to want the person who maybe sets a bold vision out there that the group can follow. You know, there's so many different ways to lead a group to greatness. And I actually believe that having multiple facets to that leadership gets the group to a better place than just having one of those.
That's the diversity of the ensemble. So people who have a diversity of ideas and viewpoints and the minute that Second City broke out of the old pattern of four straight white guys, two straight white women, which served them for, you know, many years, the work became so much more interesting, and we were able to make so many more discoveries. And guess what? It was really hard to get there. It was not comfortable. One of my favorite things.
I'm not surprised. I mean, that isn't comfortable. And yet, part of the reason you were probably successful is because you didn't just put diversity together. You didn't just grab random people and say, all right, you're diverse now, go for it. You actually had to respect what each person was doing and give them room to lead from their perspective.
Totally. And it's often, it's funny because I use Keegan-Michael Key as an example. So many people love Key and Peele, as they should. Both those guys are brilliant. I work with both of them. You know, Keegan brought a very intriguing level of diversity, not just in terms of race, but he came in as a born-again Christian, which at Second City was a very foreign entity. But that his faith and his upbringing really informed the work in such a – and he was doing the shows right around 9/11. So you had all this sort of rich material to work with at a very, very difficult time. And I think – we all benefited from it. Like, audiences benefited from seeing this artist sort of develop. He benefited by being in a place where he could be accepted and spread his wings. And then, you know, the artistic output is just tremendous.
Yeah, that is amazing. I love that story.
All right. So I'm going to let you tell a story. So we always ask our guests for a yes and story. So the idea in improv, of course, is that if groups of people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere saying no. And they can't just stop at yes. They have to say yes and. They have to affirm and add to it. And I'm wondering if you have a story from your life or business where you maybe were going to say no, but instead you said yes and.
Yeah, I struggled to choose here because I actually think when I've been happiest in life and in work has been the time that I've said yes and. So that there seemed like there were so many choices. But I decided to go back to the beginning, and it actually links to your question about does everybody want to be a leader. You know, one of my very, very first jobs out of college, I was a brand new consultant. I really thought I had to be a certain way to make a good impression. So I was very buttoned up, very detail oriented, all these things that are actually not at all my natural business chemistry. But within the first week of my project, we went out with a client, and the client ordered oyster shots. Well, I was barely over the age of 21 at this point. I barely had shots, let alone anything like an oyster shot. I don't think I'd even tried an oyster before. Mm-hmm. And I was extremely concerned that I would be seen as somebody who wasn't this serious, buttoned-up person that could get their work done for them. And so I declined, and I was sort of off to the side of the group. And I had a moment sitting there where I said, wait a second, this is crazy. I'm intentionally setting myself apart from the group. I'm missing an opportunity to build relationships with them. You know, why not? Let's at least start with the yes. So I tried the oyster shot. I can't admit it was my favorite drink ever, but I did try it. But then I decided to add a little more. And so I brought up that I had heard this guy talking about musical theater, and that you know, I used to do some musical theater in high school, and we got to talking, struck up a great conversation, and by the end of the evening, we're singing show tunes around the piano. And that relationship was such a fabulous foundation to the project work I had to get done, and it was a really great reminder to be yourself and to be human.
I love the fact that the yes and story is oyster shots to singing show tunes. It could not. That is a entirely unique yes and story. The book is called Business Chemistry: Practical Magic for Crafting Powerful Work Relationships. Kim Christofort, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.